Winslow. Mia would be there, she knew, working on her photographs. Mrs. Richardson opened the shared side door and entered without knocking. This was her house, after all, not Mia's. As a landlord, she had the right. The downstairs apartment was silent. It was 11 o'clock and Mr. Yang was at work. Upstairs, however, she could hear Mia in the kitchen, the rumble of a kettle coming to a boil, a whistle springing to life and then subsiding as someone lifted it from the stove. Mrs. Richardson climbed the steps to the second floor, noting the linoleum that was just beginning to peel at the corners of the treads. That would have to be fixed, she thought. She would have the entire staircase, no, the entire apartment, stripped bare and redone. The door to the upstairs apartment was unlocked, and Mia looked up, alarmed, as Mrs. Richardson came to the kitchen. "I didn't expect anyone," she said. The kettle gave a faint whine as she set it back on the hot burner. "Did you need something?" Mrs. Richardson's gaze swept over the apartment. The sink with Pearl's breakfast dishes still stacked over the drain. The array of pillows that passed for a couch. The half-open door to Mia's bedroom, where a mattress lay on the carpet. It was such a pathetic life, she thought. They had so little. And then she spotted something familiar, draped over the back of one of the mismatched kitchen chairs. Izzy's jacket. Izzy had left it there on her last visit, and the casual carelessness of this gesture affronted Mrs. Richardson. As if Izzy lived here. As if this were her home. As if she were Mia's daughter, not Mrs. Richardson's own. "I always knew there was something about you," she said. "Pardon?" Mrs. Richardson did not respond right away. Not even a real bed, she thought. Not even a real couch. What kind of grown woman sits on the floor, sleeps on the floor? What kind of life was this? "I suppose you thought you could hide," she said to the kitchen table, where Mia had been carefully splicing a photograph of a dog and a man together. "I suppose you thought no one would ever know." "I don't know what you're talking about," Mia began. Her knuckles clenched the handle of her mug. "Don't you? I'm sure Joseph and Madeline Ryan do." Mia went silent. "I'm sure they'd like to know where you are. So would your parents. I'm sure they'd love to know where Pearl is, too." Mrs. Richardson shot Mia a glance. "Don't try to lie about it. You're a very good liar, but I know all about it. I know all about you." "What do you want?" "I almost didn't say anything. I thought, what's in the past is past. Maybe she's made a new life. But I see you've raised your daughter to be just as immoral as you." "Pearl?" Mia's eyes went wide. "What are you talking about?" "What a hypocrite you are. You stole that couple's child, and then you try to take a baby away from the McCulloughs. Pearl is my child. You had a little help making her, didn't you?" Mrs. Richardson raised an eyebrow. "Linda McCullough and I have been friends for 40 years. She's like a sister to me, and no one deserves a child more than she does." "It's not a question of deserving. I just think a mother has a right to raise her own child." "Do you? Or is that just what you tell yourself so you can sleep at night?" Mia flushed. "If Malin could choose, don't you think she'd choose to stay with her real mother? The mother who gave birth to her?"
"Maybe."
Mrs. Richardson looked at Mia closely. "The Ryans are rich. They wanted a baby so desperately, they'd have given her a wonderful life. If Pearl had gotten to choose, do you think she'd have chosen to stay with you? To live like a vagabond?" "It bothers you, doesn't it?" Mia said suddenly. "I think you can't imagine why anyone would choose a different life from the one you've got. Why anyone might want something other than a big house with a big lawn, a fancy car, a job in an office. Why anyone would choose anything different than what you choose." Now it was her turn to study Mrs. Richardson, as if a key to understanding her were coded into her face. "It terrifies you. That you missed out on something. That you gave up something you didn't know you wanted." A sharp, pitying smile pinched the corners of her lips. What was it? Was it a boy? Was it a vocation? Or was it a whole life? Mrs. Richardson shuffled the snippets of Mia's photographs on the table. Under her hands, pieces of dog and pieces of man separated and mingled and reformed. "I think it's time you moved on," she said. With one hand, she lifted Izzy's jacket from the chair and dusted it, as if it were soiled. "By tomorrow." She set a folded $100 bill on the counter. "This should more than make up for the rent for the month. We'll call it even." "Why are you doing this?" Mrs. Richardson headed for the door. "Ask your daughter," she said, and the door shut behind her. 19. Friday afternoon, when the bell rang at just after 1, Pearl settled herself into 7th period and set her bag beside her chair. She was going to meet Tripp at his car after school. He had put a note into her locker that morning. Lexi had left another after lunch. "Movie tonight? Deep Impact?" It was almost enough to make her forget that she and Moody were no longer friends. Every day they still saw each other in class, but most days he jumped up as soon as the bell rang and bolted out the door before she'd even had a chance to close her binder. Now there he was across the aisle, bent over his copy of Othello. She wondered if they'd ever get back to normal, if things would ever be the same between them. Sex changed things, she realized. Not just between you and the other person, but between you and everyone. She was still turning this insight over in her mind when the classroom phone rang. It was usually a question from the main office about something, a misplaced attendance sheet, an excuse for a tardy student, so she paid no attention until Mrs. Thomas hung up and came to crouch by her desk. "Pearl," she said softly, "the office says your mother's here to pick you up. Take your things with you," they said. She went back to the board where she was outlining the third act of the play, and Pearl puzzled over this as she packed her books away. Was there an appointment she'd forgotten? Was there some kind of emergency? Out of instinct, she shot a quick look at Moody in the next seat, the closest they'd come to a conversation in weeks. But Moody seemed as clueless as she was, and the last thing she remembered as she left the classroom was his face, their shared moment of confusion. She came out of the science wing door and saw her mother parked by the curb, leaning back against the little tan rabbit, waiting for her. "There you are," Mia said. "Mom? What are you doing here?" Pearl glanced over her shoulder, in the universal reaction of all teenagers confronted by their parents in a public place. "Do you have anything important in your locker?" Mia unzipped Pearl's bag and peeked inside. "Your wallet? Any papers?" "Okay, let's go." She turned back toward the car, and Pearl jerked herself free. "Mom, I can't. I have a biology quiz next period, and I'm meeting somebody after school. I'll just see you at home, okay?" "That's not what I mean," said Mia, and Pearl noticed the wrinkle between her mother's eyebrows that meant she was deeply worried. "I mean, we have to go. Today." "What?" Pearl glanced around. The oval lay quiet and green before them. Everyone was inside, in class, except for a few students clustered, just off school grounds, at the nearby traffic triangle, smoking. Everything seemed so normal.
"I don't want to leave."
"I know, my darling, but we have to." Every time before, when her mother had decided to leave, Pearl had felt, at most, a twinge of regret, always over the minor things. A boy she'd admired from afar, a certain park bench or quiet corner or library book she hated to leave behind. Mostly, however, she had felt relief that she could slide out of this life and begin anew, like a snake shedding its skin. This time, all that welled up inside her was a mixture of grief and rage.
"You promised we could stay," she said, her voice thickening.
"Mom, I have friends here. I have..." She looked around, as if one of the Richardson children might appear. But Lexi was off in the social room finishing her lunch. Moody was back in English class discussing Othello. And Tripp would be waiting for her after school on the other side of the oval. When she didn't appear, he would drive away. She had a wild thought. If she could only run to the Richardson house, she would be safe. Mrs. Richardson would help her, she was sure. The Richardsons would take her in. The Richardsons would never let her go. "Please, Mom."
Please. Please don't make us go.
I don't want to, but we have to. Mia held out her hand. Pearl, for a moment, imagined herself transforming into a tree, rooting herself so deeply on that spot that nothing could displace her. Pearl, my darling, her mother said. I'm so sorry. It's time to go. She took Mia's hand, and Pearl, uprooted, came free and followed her mother back to the car. When they got back to the house on Winslow, a few belongings were already packed. The couch had been stripped of its blanket and disassembled into a stack of pillows. The various prints Mia had tacked to the wall had been boxed. Mia was a fast packer, good at squeezing an improbably large number of things into a tight space. In their year in Shaker, however, they'd acquired more things than they'd ever had before, and this time many more things would need to be left behind. I thought I'd be finished by now, Mia admitted, setting her keys down on the table. But I had to finish something. Fold up your clothes, whatever will fit in your duffel bag.
You promised, Pearl said.
In the safe cocoon of their home, their real home as she'd begun to think of it, the tears began to flow, along with a choking rush of fury.
You said we were staying put. You said this was it.
Mia stopped and put an arm around Pearl.
I know I did, she said. I promised, and I'm sorry. Something's happened.
I'm not going. Pearl kicked her shoes onto the floor and stomped into the living room. Mia heard the door to her room slam. Sighing, she picked up Pearl's sneakers by the heels and went down the hallway. Pearl had flopped on her bed, math books spread in front of her, jerking a notebook from her book bag. A furious charade.
It's time.
I have to do my homework.
We have to pack.
Mia gently closed the textbook. And then we have to leave.
Pearl snatched the textbook from her mother's hands and threw it across the room, where it left a black smudge on the wall. Next went her notebook, her ballpoint, her history book, a stack of note cards, until her book bag lay crumpled on the floor like a shed skin, and everything that had been inside it had scattered. Mia sat quietly beside her, waiting. Pearl was no longer crying. Her tears had been replaced by a cold, blank face and a set jaw.
I thought we could stay, too, Mia said at last.
Why? Pearl pulled her knees to her chest and wrapped her arms around them and glared at her mother.
I'm not going until you tell me why.
That's fair, Mia sighed. She sat down beside Pearl on the bed and smoothed the bedspread beneath them. It was afternoon. It was sunny. Outside, a morning dove cooed. The low hum of a lawnmower rose. A passing cloud cast them into shadow for a moment, then drifted away, as if it were simply an ordinary day.
I've been thinking about how to tell you for a long time. Longer than you can imagine.
Pearl had gone very still now, her eyes fixed on her mother, waiting patiently, aware she was about to learn something very important.
Mia thought of Joseph Ryan, sitting across the table from her that night at dinner, waiting to learn her answer.
Let me tell you first, she said, taking a deep breath, about your Uncle Warren.
When Mia had finished, Pearl sat quietly, tracing the lines of quilting that spiraled across the bedspread. She had told Pearl the outline of everything, though they both knew all the details would be a long time in coming. They would trickle out in dribs and drabs, memories surfacing suddenly, prompted by the merest thread, the way memories often do. For years afterward, Mia would spot a yellow house as they drove by, or a battered repair truck, or see two children climbing up a hillside, and would say, "Did I ever tell you?" And Pearl would snap to attention, ready to gather another small glittering shard of her history. Everything, she had come to understand, was something like infinity. They might never come close, but they could approach a point where, for all intents and purposes, she knew all that she needed to know. It would simply take time and patience. For now, she knew enough.
"Why are you telling me this?" she had asked her mother. "I mean, why are you telling me this now?"
Mia had taken a deep breath.
How did you explain to someone? How did you explain to a child you loved, that someone they adored was not to be trusted? She tried. She did her best to explain, and she had watched confusion wash over Pearl's face. Then pain. Pearl could not understand it. Mrs. Richardson, who had always been so kind to her, who had said so many nice things about her, whose shining, polished surface had entranced Pearl with her own reflection. "She's right, though," Mia said at last. "The Ryans would have given you a wonderful life. They'd have loved you. And Mr. Ryan is your father." She had never said those words aloud, had never even allowed herself to think them, and they tasted strange on her tongue. She said it again. "Your father." Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Pearl mouthing the words to herself as if trying them out. "Do you want to meet them?" Mia asked. "We can drive to New York. They won't be hard to find." Pearl thought about this for a long time. "Not right now," she said. "Maybe one day, but not right now." She leaned into her mother's arms, the way she had when she was a child, tucking herself neatly under her mother's chin. "And what about your parents?" she said after a moment.
"My parents? Are they still out there? Do you know where they are?"
Mia hesitated. "Yes," she said. "I believe I do."
"Do you want to meet them?"
Pearl tipped her head to one side. In a gesture that reminded Mia so strongly of Warren, it made her catch her breath. "Someday," she said. "Someday maybe we could go and see them together." Mia held her for a moment, buried her nose in the part of Pearl's hair. Every time she did this, she was comforted by how Pearl smelled exactly the same. She smelled, Mia thought suddenly, of home. As if home had never been a place, but had always been this little person whom she'd carried alongside her.
"And now we'd better pack," she said. It was 3:30. School was out, Pearl thought, as she began to roll up her clothing. Moody would just be getting home. Tripp would have given up on her by now.
Or would he be waiting for her still? When she didn't show up, would he come looking for her? She hadn't yet told her mother about Tripp. She wasn't sure yet if she ever would.
There was a knock at the side door.
To Pearl, it was as if she'd summoned Tripp with her mind, and she turned to Mia, wide-eyed.
"I'll go and see who it is," Mia said. "You stay up here. Keep packing." If it was Mrs. Richardson, she thought. But no, it was Izzy, standing bewildered in the driveway.
"Why is the door locked?" she said.
For months, she'd been coming to help Mia every afternoon, and the side door had never before been locked. It had been open to her, to all the Richardson children, it occurred to her now, at any moment of the day, no matter what her trouble.
I was taking care of something."
Mia had forgotten all about Izzy, and she tried to think of a plausible excuse.
"Is Bibi still here?"
This was the only thing Izzy could think of that might make Mia shut her out and send her away.
"No, she's gone home. I was busy."
"Okay."
Izzy took a half-step back from the doorway, and the storm door, which she'd been holding open with her foot, gave a faint shriek.
"Well, is Pearl here? I wanted to tell her something."
She'd been trying to catch Pearl all day. In fact, she had tried to call Pearl the previous night, but had gotten only a busy signal. Mia, while comforting Bibi, had taken the phone off the hook and had forgotten to put it back on. She tried over and over until past midnight, deciding at last that she'd find Pearl at school in the morning. Pearl, she felt, ought to know what Moody had said about her, that her mother knew about Tripp. But she didn't know which routes Pearl might take from class to class. Would she take the main stairwell with its crush of students, or the back one that led down to the English wing? Would she eat in the cafeteria or in the egress downstairs, or perhaps out on the lawn somewhere? Each time she guessed wrong, and Izzy was frustrated at missing Pearl again and again, even more frustrated at how poorly she seemed to know Pearl. Right after school, she promised herself she would find Pearl and tell her everything. Now, face to face with Mia, she could tell something was wrong, but wasn't sure what.
Did Mia already know? Was Pearl in trouble?
Was Mia, for some reason, angry at her, too?
Mia looked down at Izzy's anxious face and could not tell whether lying or telling the truth would hurt her more.
She decided to do neither.
I'll tell her you came by, okay? She said.
Okay, Izzy said again. With one hand on the doorknob, she peeked up at Mia through her hair.
Had she done something wrong, she wondered. Had she made Mia angry?
Izzy, Lexi had always said, had no poker face, and it was true. Izzy never bothered to hide her feelings, didn't even know how. She looked so young at that moment, so confused and vulnerable and lonely, and this, more than anything, made Mia feel she'd failed her.
"Remember what I said the other day?" she said.
"About the prairie fires? About how sometimes you need to scorch everything to the ground and start over?" Izzy nodded.
"Well," Mia said. A long moment unraveled between them. She could not think of a way to say goodbye.
"Just remember that," she finished. "Sometimes you need to start over from scratch. Can you understand that?"
Izzy wasn't sure she did, but she nodded again.
"See you tomorrow," she said. And Mia's heart cracked. Instead of answering, she pulled Izzy into her arms and kissed her on the top of her head, the same place where she often kissed Pearl.
"See you soon," she said.
Pearl heard the door close, but it was a few minutes before Mia came back upstairs, her feet slow and heavy on the steps.
"Who was it?" she asked, though she had a good idea by now.
"Izzy," Mia said. "But she's gone." And she turned into her bedroom to pack. They had done this so many times before. Two glasses stacked, their handful of silverware corralled inside, glasses nested into bowls, bowls nested into pot, pot nested into frying pan, the whole thing wrapped in a paper grocery sack and cushioned with whatever food would keep. A sleeve of crackers, a jar of peanut butter, half a loaf of bread. Another bag held shampoo, a bar of soap, a tube of toothpaste. Mia wedged their duffel bags into the footwells and laid a stack of blankets on top. Her cameras and her supplies went into the trunk, along with the dishes and toiletries. Everything else, the gate-leg table they'd painted blue, the mismatched chairs, Pearl's bed and Mia's mattress, and the tussock of pillows they'd called a couch, would be left behind. It was almost dark by the time they'd finished, and Pearl kept thinking about Tripp and Lexi and Moody and Izzy. They'd be home now, in their beautiful house. Tripp would be wondering why she hadn't come to meet him. She would never get to see him again, she thought, and her throat burned. Lexi would be perched at the counter, twirling a lock of hair around her finger, wondering where she was. And Moody? They would never have the chance to make up.
"It isn't fair," she said, as her mother put the last of their things in a paper grocery bag.
"No," Mia agreed. "It's not."
Pearl waited for a parental platitude to follow. "Life isn't fair," or "fair doesn't always mean right." Instead, Mia held her close for a moment, kissed her on the side of the head, then handed her the grocery sack. "Go put this in the car." When Pearl returned, she found her mother in the kitchen, setting a plain manila envelope on the kitchen counter.
"What's that?" Pearl asked, interested in spite of herself.
"Something for the Richardsons," Mia said.
"A goodbye, I guess."
"A letter? Can I read it?"
"No. Some photographs."
"You're just leaving them here?"
Pearl had never known her mother to leave any of her work behind. When they left an apartment, they took everything that was truly theirs with them, and Mia's photos were the most important. Once, when they hadn't had enough space in the trunk of the rabbit, Mia had jettisoned half of her clothing to make room.
"They're not mine." Mia took her keys from the counter.
"Who else's could they be?" Pearl insisted.
"Some pictures," Mia said, "belong to the person who took them, and some belong to the person inside them."
"Are you ready?"
She flicked off the lights.
Across town, Bibi sat on the curb in the shadow of a parked BMW and watched the McCullough's house across the street. She'd been sitting there for some time, and now it was 7:30, and inside, her daughter must be having her bath. Linda McCullough, she knew, liked to keep to a schedule. "I always find that regular habits make for a calmer life," she had told Bibi more than once, especially on the days Bibi was late for her visitation. As if, Bibi thought, as if she were just offering her own opinion on the subject, free of judgment, as if she were expressing a preference for apples over pears. The light in the upstairs bathroom clicked on, and Bibi pictured it, Mei Ling holding on to the white porcelain edge of the bathtub, one hand stretching to touch the water as it tumbled from the faucet. The street was quiet now, lights glowing softly in the living rooms, an occasional blue flicker from a TV, but when she closed her eyes, she could almost hear her daughter laughing as a spray of droplets flecked her face. Mei Ling had always loved water. Even in those hungry days, she had calmed when Bibi had lowered her into the kitchen sink for a bath. And when Bibi had lost the energy even for this, afraid the baby would wriggle from her hands, afraid she might simply lie down on the scuffed linoleum and let the child slip beneath the surface, Mei Ling had screamed all the more. Mrs. McCullough, she was sure, must have an array of bath products at her disposal. All those lotions and soaps and creams made just for babies, rich with shea butter and almond oil and lavender. They would be lined up along the edge of the tub, no, on a fancy glass rack, safely out of reach of inquisitive little hands. And there'd be toys, too, bins of them, not just an old yogurt cup for rinsing her hair, but ducks and wind-up frogs, dolphins, boats and aeroplanes, miniature versions of the marvelous life Mei Ling would have with the McCulloughs. After the bath, Mrs. McCullough would wrap Mei Ling in a fluffy white towel, so plush that when she unwound it, there would be a perfect imprint of the little girl in it, right down to her thumbprint navel. She would brush Mei Ling's hair, which was straight when dry but wavy when wet, just like her mother's, and coax her damp limbs into pajamas. And then she would give Mei Ling her bottle and put her to bed. Bibi watched the light in the bathroom go out, and in a moment saw the light at the back of the house, Mei Ling's room, go on. Mei Ling would fall asleep, milk-sated and warm in that cozy crib, snug under a hand-knit coverlet, a wall of crib bumpers shielding her from the hard slats of the sides. She would fall asleep, and Mrs. McCullough would turn on the nightlight and close the door. And when she went to bed herself, she would already be looking forward to the morning, when she would come in and find Bibi's daughter there waiting for her. Bibi leaned her head against the BMW and waited for the light in her daughter's room to go out. Izzy came home from Mia's to an empty house. Her parents, of course, were still at work, but one of her siblings was usually around. Where was Lexi, she wondered. Where was Moody? Trip, she decided, must be out with Pearl. She hoped she could catch Pearl before her mother arrived home. As it happened, Trip and Moody had arrived home earlier. Moody right after school, and unexpectedly, Trip a short while later. Trip seemed grumpy and at loose ends, and Moody suspected, correctly, that he'd planned to meet Pearl and something had gone amiss. "Bad day?" Trip grunted. "She stood you up," Moody went on, clucking his tongue. "Sucks, man. But I mean, what did you expect?" "What are you talking about?" Trip said, turning to Moody at last. And Moody felt a mean thrill shoot through him. "Did you think you were the only one?" he said. "You think anyone's dumb enough to save themselves for you? I just can't believe you didn't catch on sooner." He laughed, and it was then that Trip dove at him. They hadn't scrapped like this in years, since they were boys, and with a sudden sense of relief, Moody laughed again, even as Trip socked him in the stomach and they toppled onto the floor. For a few moments, they scuffled on the tile, their shoes leaving streaks on the cabinet doors, and then Trip got Moody into a headlock, and the fight was over. "You shut up," Trip hissed. "Just shut the fuck up!" Since the first time he'd kissed Pearl, he'd wondered what she saw in him, had wondered if she might, sooner or later, decide she'd made a mistake choosing him. It was as if Moody had somehow peered into his brain and spoken all his fears out loud. Moody sputtered and pulled at Tripp's arm, and Tripp finally let him go and stormed off. After half an hour of aimless driving, he headed to Dan Simon's house. In the days before Pearl, he and Dan and some of their hockey teammates had spent hours hunched around Dan's Nintendo playing GoldenEye, and this afternoon he hoped that video game haze would distract him from what Moody had said, from wondering if it was true. Moody, meanwhile, headed to Horseshoe Lake, where he thought about all the things he wished he'd said to his brother. Today, and over all the years. Izzy, home alone, turned Mia's words over and over in her head. Sometimes, you need to start over from scratch. At 5, Mia had not yet arrived to prepare dinner, and an uneasy feeling grew in the pit of her stomach. It only intensified when her mother called at 5:30. "Mia can't come today," she said. "I'll pick up some Chinese food on the way home." When Moody finally came home at a little past 6, she ran downstairs. "Where is everyone?" she demanded. Moody shrugged off his flannel shirt and tossed it onto the couch. He had sat at the lake for hours, throwing rocks into the water, thinking about Pearl and his brother. "Look what you did to her," he thought furiously. "How could you put her through that?" He had thrown every rock he could find, and it was still not enough. "How would I know?" he said to Izzy. "Lexi's probably over at Serena's. Who knows where the fuck Trip is?" He stopped. "What do you care? I thought you liked being alone." "I was looking for Pearl. Have you seen her?" "Saw her in English." Moody went into the kitchen to get a soda, with Izzy trailing after him. "Not since then. She left class early." He took a swig. "Maybe she's with Tripp?" Izzy suggested. Moody swallowed and paused. Izzy, noticing that he did not contradict her, pressed her advantage. "Is that true, what you said last night about Pearl and Tripp?"
"Apparently."
"Why did you tell Mom?"
"I didn't think it was a secret."
Moody set the can down on the counter.
"It's not like they were subtle about it. And it's not my job to lie for them."
"Mom said..." Izzy hesitated. "Mom said Pearl had an abortion?"
"That's what she said."
"Pearl didn't have an abortion."
"How would you know?"
"Because..." Izzy couldn't explain, but she was sure she was right about this. Tripp and Pearl, that she could believe. She had seen Pearl watching Tripp for months, like a mouse watching a cat longing to be eaten. But Pearl, pregnant? She thought back. Had Pearl seemed unusual at all? Izzy froze. She remembered the day she'd gone to Mia's and Lexi had been there. What had Lexi said? That she'd come over to see Pearl, that Pearl was helping her with an essay. Lexi, usually so coiffed, was disheveled and wan, hair in a limp ponytail, and Mia had been so quick to shoo Izzy away. She thought back further. Lexi coming home the next afternoon in Pearl's favorite green T-shirt, the one with John Lennon on the front. In one hand, she'd clutched a plastic bag with something inside it. She'd stayed in her room all evening, skipping dinner, again, unlike Lexi, who had an appetite, and had been in a sour mood for weeks afterward. Even now, Izzy thought, her sister seemed less effervescent, less gregarious, as if a damper had been closed. And she and Brian had broken up.
"Where's Lexi?" she said again.
"I told you, I think she's at Serena's." Moody grabbed Izzy's arm.
"Keep your mouth shut about Tripp and Pearl, okay? I don't think she knows."
"You are such a fucking idiot." Izzy shook herself free. "Pearl wasn't pregnant. You realize Mom and her mom are probably gonna kill her, and you threw her under the bus for no reason?"
Moody blanched, but only for a moment. Then he shook his head. "I don't care. She deserved it."
"She deserved it?" Izzy stared. "She was sneaking around with Tripp."
"Tripp? Of all people, Izzy. She didn't even care that..."
He stopped, as if he had pressed too hard on a fresh bruise.
"Look, she decided to sleep around. She deserves whatever she gets."
"I cannot believe you." Izzy had never seen her brother act this way. Moody, who had always been the most thoughtful person in her family. Moody, who had always taken her side even if she chose not to take his advice. Moody, the person in her family she'd always trusted to see things more clearly than she could. "You realize," she said, "that Mom is probably going to blame Mia for all of this." Moody shifted.
"Well," he said, "maybe she should have kept a closer eye on her daughter. Maybe she should have raised her to be more responsible."
He reached for his can of soda, but Izzy got it first. The cold metal smashed into his cheekbone, and a spray of fizz and froth hit him squarely in the face. By the time he could see again, Izzy was gone, and he was alone, except for the can rolling slowly away across the wet kitchen tile. Serena's house was on Shaker Boulevard, by the middle school, nearly 2 miles away. 40 minutes later, Serena answered the doorbell to find Izzy, breathless, on the front steps.
"What are you doing here, freak?" Lexi said,
coming down the stairs behind Serena.
"I need to ask you something," Izzy said.
"Ever heard of the telephone?"
"Shut up! It's important!"
Izzy pulled her sister by the arm into the living room, and Serena, familiar with Richardson family dynamics, retreated to the kitchen to give them some privacy.
"What?" Lexi said when they were alone.
"Did you have an abortion?" Izzy said.
"What?" Lexi's voice dropped to a whisper.
"When Mom was out of town, did you?"
"It's none of your fucking business." Lexi turned to go, but Izzy barreled ahead.
"You did, didn't you? That time you said you slept over at Pearl's?"
"It's not a crime, Izzy. Tons of people do it."
"Did Pearl go with you?"
Lexi sighed. "She drove me, and before you start getting all moralistic and self-righteous..."
"I don't care about your morals, Lex!"
Izzy flicked her hair out of her face impatiently. "Mom thinks Pearl's the one who had it."
"Pearl?" Lexi laughed.
"Sorry, that's just funny. Virginal, innocent little Pearl."
"She must think that for a reason."
"I made the appointment under Pearl's name," Lexi said.
"Whatever. She didn't mind."
She turned to go, then wheeled around again.
"Don't you dare tell anyone about this. Not Moody, not Mom, not anyone. Got it?"
"You're so fucking selfish," Izzy said. Without saying goodbye, she pushed past Lexi into the front hallway, where she nearly knocked Serena over on her way out the door. It took her another 40 minutes on foot to reach the little house on Winslow, and by the time she got there, she knew something was wrong. All the lights upstairs were off, and there was no sign of the rabbit in the driveway. She hesitated for a moment on the front walk, poking at the peach tree where the blossoms were shriveling and turning brown. Then she went around to the side of the house and rang the doorbell until Mr. Yang answered.
"Is Mia here?" she said. "Or Pearl?"
Mr. Yang shook his head.
"They leave maybe 5-10 minutes ago."
Izzy's heart went leaden and cold.
"Did they happen to say where they were going?"
she asked, though she already knew the truth. She had missed them and they were gone. Mr. Yang shook his head again.
"They don't tell me."
He had peeked out from behind the curtains just in time to see Mia and Pearl backing carefully out of the driveway, the rabbit piled high with bags and boxes, and driving off into the growing darkness. They had been good people, he thought sadly, and he wished them a safe journey wherever they were headed. A note, Izzy thought wildly. There must be a note. Mia would not have left without a goodbye.
"Can I go up and check their apartment for something?" she said. "I promise I won't bother anything."
"You have a key?"
Mr. Yang opened the door and let Izzy clomp up the stairs.
"Maybe the door locked."
It was, in fact, and Izzy knocked several times and rattled the doorknob before giving up and coming back down.
"I don't have key," Mr. Yang said.
He held the storm door open as Izzy rushed outside.
"You ask your mommy. She have the key."
It took Izzy 25 minutes to walk home, where, although she would never know it, Mia and Pearl had dropped off their keys just a short time earlier. It took her another 30 minutes to find her mother's spare keys to the Winslow house in the catch-all drawer in the kitchen. She was quiet, ignoring the half-eaten carton of lo mein and orange chicken left on the counter for her. Careful not to disturb her brothers or her parents, who by then had dispersed to their various corners of the house. By the time she returned to Winslow Road, it was 9:30, and Mr. Yang, who on weekdays rose at 4:15 in order to drive his school bus route and liked to keep a regular schedule, had already gone to bed. So no one heard Izzy come in through the side door, unlock the door to Mia and Pearl's apartment, and step inside at last, knowing deep down that she was too late, that they were gone for good. By 9 the next morning, the Richardson house was nearly empty as well. Mr. Richardson had gone into the office to catch up, as he often did on Saturday mornings. The recent developments in the McCullough case had set him behind in everything else. Lexi was asleep across town in Serena's queen-size bed. Tripp and Moody had both gone out, Tripp to distract himself with a pickup game at the community center, Moody on his bike to Pearl's house, where he intended to apologize, but instead, to his consternation, found a locked door and no Volkswagen. And on Saturday mornings, Izzy knew, Mrs. Richardson always went to the rec center pool to swim laps. Her mother was such a creature of habit that Izzy didn't even bother to peek into her bedroom. She was certain she had the house to herself. It was unfair. All of it. Deeply unfair. That was the one thought that had pulsed through Izzy's mind all night. That Mia and Pearl had had to leave. That they'd finally made a home, and now they had been driven away. The kindest people she knew, the most caring, the most sincere. And they'd been chased away by her family. In her mind, she cataloged the many betrayals. Lexi had lied. She'd used Pearl. Tripp had taken advantage of her. Moody had betrayed her on purpose. Her father was a baby stealer, and her mother, well, her mother had been at the root of it all. She thought of Mia's house, glowing golden and warm. All her life she'd felt hard and angry, her mother always criticizing her. Lexi and Tripp always mocking her. Mia hadn't been like that. With Mia, she'd been different, in a way she hadn't known she could be. In Mia's accepting presence, she'd become curious and kind and open, as if under a magic spell. She had felt, finally, as if she could speak without immediately bumping into the hard shell of her sheltered life, as if she suddenly saw that the solid walls penning her in were actually bars, with spaces between them wide enough to slip through. Now Izzy tried to imagine going back to life as it had been before. Life in their beautiful, perfectly ordered, abundantly furnished house, where the grass was always cut and the leaves were always raked and there was never, ever any garbage in sight. In their beautiful, perfectly ordered neighborhood, where every lawn had a tree and the streets curved so that no one went too fast and every house harmonized with the next. In their beautiful, perfectly ordered city, where everyone got along. And everyone followed the rules, and everything had to be beautiful and perfect on the outside, no matter what mess lay within. She could not pretend that nothing had happened. Mia had opened a door in her that could not be shut again. And then she thought about the first day she'd met Mia, what Mia had asked her. "What are you going to do about it?" It was the first time Izzy had ever felt there was something she could do about anything. Now she remembered what Mia had said to her the last time they'd seen each other. The words that had been echoing through her head ever since. How sometimes you needed to start over from scratch. "Scorched earth," she had said. And at that moment, Izzy decided what she was going to do. She had spent the night planning. And now that it was time, she hardly thought at all. It was as if she were standing outside herself, watching someone else do these things. Their father always kept a can of gasoline in the garage to fill the snowblower and to power the generator if the power went out during a storm. With a jerry can, Izzy made a neat circle on her sister's bed, then her brother's. The gasoline made a dark, oily blotch on Lexi's flowered comforter, on Tripp's pillow, on Moody's plaid sheets. By the time she'd finished in Moody's room, the can was empty, so she contented herself with setting it outside the closed door of her parents' bedroom. Then she replaced the keys to the Winslow house in the catch-all drawer and removed the box of matches. "Remember," Mia had said, Sometimes you need to scorch everything to the ground and start over. After the burning, the soil is richer, and new things can grow. People are like that, too. They start over. They find a way. She thought of Mia now, and her eyes began to burn, and she scraped the first match against the side of the box. On her shoulder, she had her book bag stuffed with a change of clothes, all the money she owned. They couldn't be far ahead, she thought. There was still time to find them. The sandpaper grated under the match head like nails on a chalkboard, and there was a whiff of sulfur and the tip flared bright. And Izzy dropped it onto her sister's flowered comforter and ran out the door. 20. After the fire trucks had gone, the shell of the Richardson house now gaping and blackened and steaming gently, Mrs. Richardson pulled her bathrobe tightly around herself and took stock. There was Mr. Richardson on what had been their front walkway, consulting with the fire chief and two policemen. There were Lexi and Tripp and Moody, perched on the hood of Lexi's car across the street, watching their parents, awaiting instruction. It had not been lost on Mrs. Richardson that Izzy was missing, and, she was sure, this was what her husband was discussing with the policemen right now. He would be giving them a description, asking them to help find her. Isabel Marie Richardson, she thought with a mixture of fury and shame. What on earth have you done? She said as much to the policeman, to the firemen, to her children, and her abashed husband. Reckless, she said. How could she do this? Behind her, one of the firemen placed the charred remnants of the jerry can into the truck, to send to the insurance company, she had no doubt. When Izzy comes back, Lexi murmured to Tripp, Mom is going to slaughter her. It was only when the fire chief asked where they would be staying that Mrs. Richardson saw the obvious solution. At our rental house, she said, over on Winslow Road, near Linfield. To her puzzled husband and children, she said only, It was vacated yesterday. It took some maneuvering to fit three cars into the narrow driveway at the Winslow house, and while Lexi finally parked her Explorer by the curb, Mrs. Richardson had a sudden fear that the apartment would not be empty after all, that they might go upstairs and open the door and find Mia and Pearl still there, placidly eating their lunches at the table, refusing to leave. Or perhaps Mia would have left behind some kind of statement, a mess to clean up, broken windows or smashed walls, one last middle finger to her landlords. But when the Richardson family had stowed all four cars at last and paraded up the steps, much to Mr. Yang's confusion, there was no sign of anyone upstairs, just a few pieces of discarded furniture. Mrs. Richardson nodded in approval and relief. It looks so different, Lexi murmured. And it did. The three remaining Richardson children clustered together in the doorway between the living room and the kitchen, so close their shoulders nearly touched. In the kitchen, the cupboards were empty, the two mismatched chairs pushed neatly under the rickety table. Moody thought of how many times he'd sat at that table beside Pearl, doing homework, eating the bowl of cereal. Lexi scanned the living room. Only a few throw pillows stacked on the carpet, bare walls now except for some stray thumbtack holes in the plaster. Tripp glanced toward the bedroom, where through the open door he could see Pearl's bed, stripped of its sheets and blankets, reduced now to a bare mattress and frame. Perfectly serviceable, Mrs. Richardson thought. Two bedrooms, one for the adults and one for the boys. The girls, for she was certain Izzy would be back with them shortly, could sleep on the three-season porch. A bathroom and a half, well, they would have to share. It would only be for a little while, until they could find something more suitable, until their house could be repaired. Mom! Lexi called from the kitchen. Mom, look at this! On the counter lay a large manila envelope, thick with papers. It could have been left behind by mistake, some of Mia's paperwork or Pearl's schoolwork, perhaps, overlooked in their hasty departure. Even before Mrs. Richardson touched it, though, she knew this was not the case. The paper was like satin under her fingers, the flap carefully fastened but not gummed, and as she pried the fastener open with a fingernail and opened the envelope, the remaining Richardsons clustered around her to see what it contained. There was one for each of them. Mia had stacked them neatly inside, half portraits, half wishes, caught on paper. Each of the Richardsons, As Mrs. Richardson carefully laid the photos out on the table in line, knew which was meant for them, recognized it instantly, as they might have recognized their own faces. To the others, it was just another photo. But to them, it was unbearably intimate, like catching a glimpse of your own naked body in a mirror. A sheet of paper sliced into strips, thin as matchsticks, woven to form a net. Suspended in its mesh, a rounded, heavy stone. The text had been sliced to unreadable bits, but Lexi recognized the pale pink of it at once, the discharge form from her visit to the clinic. On one strip ran the bottom half of her signature. No, her forged signature. Pearl's name in her own handwriting. She had left the slip at Mia's, and Mia had transformed it for her. Lexi, touching the photo, saw that beneath the weight of the rock, the intricate net bulged but did not break. It was something she would have to carry, Mia had said to her. And for the first time, she felt that perhaps she could. A hockey chest pad lying in the dirt, cracked through the center, peppered with holes. Mia had used a hammer and a handful of roofing nails, driving each one through the thick white plastic like arrows, then prying it out again. It's all right to be vulnerable, she had thought as she made each hole. It's all right to take time and see what grows. She had filled Tripp's chest pad with soil and scattered seeds on it and watered it patiently for a week until from each hole, burgeoning up through the crack, came flashes of green. Thin tendrils. Little curling leaves worming their way up into the light. Soft, fragile life emerging from within the hard shell. A flock of miniature origami birds taking flight, the largest the size of an open palm, the smallest the size of a fingernail, all faintly striped with notepaper lines. Moody recognized them at once, even before he saw the faint crinkles that textured each one. The pages from Pearl's little notebook, which he had given and then taken back, which he had destroyed and crumpled and thrown away. Although Mia had flattened the pages, the wrinkles still rippled across the birds' wings, as if the wind were ruffling their feathers. The birds lay over a photograph of sky like a scattering of petals, soaring away from a pebbled leather ground toward higher and better things. You will too, Mia had thought, as she set the birds one by one up in their paper sky. The next photograph had begun when Mia, sweeping, found one of Mr. Richardson's collar stays under the dresser. She had kept it. He had plenty of others, a whole box full on top of his dresser, every day tucking one into the point of each collar to keep it stiff. Turning the little steel strip over and over between her fingers, she remembered an experiment she'd done in science class as a child. She had rubbed it with a magnet and then floated it in a dish of water, let it spin this way and that, as it slowly settled with its point toward north. The resulting long exposure caught a bow-shaped blur, like the ghostly wings of a butterfly. Then the bright line of the collar stay as it found its bearing and grew still. Mr. Richardson, looking at the silver arrow, aligned and gleaming and certain in the clouded water, touched the collar of his shirt, wondered which way he was facing now. And last, and to Mrs. Richardson most startling of all, a paper cutout of a birdcage, shattered, as if something very powerful inside had burst free. Looking closer, she saw it was made of newsprint. Mia had sliced each word out neatly with a razor to form the gaps between the bars. It was one of her own articles, Mrs. Richardson was sure, though with all the words gone, there was no way to tell which one. The write-up of the Nature Center fundraiser, the report on the new community colonnade, the progress of the Citizens on Patrol project. Any one of the pieces she'd dutifully churned out over the years. Any one of the stories that had, despite her intentions, built the bulk of her career. Each splintered bar bent gracefully outward, like the petal of a chrysanthemum. And in the center of the empty cage lay one small golden feather. Something had escaped this cage. Something had found its wings. Mia, assembling this photograph, could think of no better wish for Mrs. Richardson. They did not realize that one photo was missing until Mrs. Richardson lifted the last to reveal a bundle of negatives. The message was clear. Mia would not try to sell them. She would not share them or hold them for some future leverage. "These are yours," the stack seemed to say. "These are you. Do what you will with them." Inside were their portraits, inverted and reversed. All the dark made light and the light made dark. But one did not match any print in the box. Izzy had removed that print the night before, when she had come into the empty apartment and found Mia and Pearl gone, and only the envelope of photos left behind as a farewell. She'd known it was hers immediately. A black rose dropped on a cracked square of pavement. The petals cut from black boot leather, her beloved boots, which had made her feel fierce, which her mother had thrown away. The outside petals from the scuffed toes, the inner, darkest petals from the tongue. A bootlace, tip fraying, stretched out long for a stem. Yellow snippets of stitching, unpicked from around the sole to form the delicate threads of its heart. Toughness rendered tender, even beautiful. Izzy had slipped it into her bag before closing the envelope again and turning out the lights and locking the door behind her. Her family, left with just the negative, could view only its tiny inverse. A pale flower fading to moon white within, a dark gray slab behind it like a cloudy night sky. It was not until late that afternoon that Mr. Richardson checked the voicemail on his cell phone and got the news. In the staticky recording, Mark McCullough was sobbing so hard Mr. Richardson could barely understand him. The night before, he and Linda, both exhausted from the verdict, the press conference, the gauntlet of the entire ordeal, had fallen into the kind of sleep they hadn't had for months. Deep, dreamless, and uninterrupted. In the morning, they woke groggy, drunken from so much rest, and Mrs. McCullough had glanced at the clock on her nightstand and realized it was 10:30. Mirabel usually woke them at sunrise, crying for breakfast, for a new diaper, and she knew as soon as she saw the red numbers on the clock that something was very wrong. She had leapt from bed and run into Mirabel's room without even putting on her slippers and her robe, and Mark McCullough, still blinking in the strong morning light, had heard her screaming from the other room. The crib was empty. Mirabel was gone. It would be a full day before the police could piece together the clues and figure out what had happened. The unlocked sliding door to the back patio. Such a safe neighborhood, not that kind of place. The latch on the inside and out, covered with fingerprints. Bibi's absence from work. Bibi's empty apartment. And finally, a ticket booked in Bibi's name for a flight to Canton at 11:20 the night before. After that, there was almost no chance, the McCulloughs were told, that they could trace her. China was a large country, the inspector told them, without a trace of irony. Bibi would have reached Canton by then, and who knew where she might go? A needle in a haystack. You could burn all your money, he told them, trying to track them down. Almost a year later, when the Richardsons' new house was nearly rebuilt, when the McCulloughs had spent not all their money, but tens of thousands of dollars on detectives and diplomatic wranglings with little result, Mrs. McCullough and Mrs. Richardson had lunched together at the Saffron Patch. They had seen each other through the past months of turmoil, as they had seen each other through decades of ups and downs, and would continue to see each other over the various hills and valleys yet to come. "Mark and I have applied to adopt a baby from China," Mrs. McCullough told Mrs. Richardson, as she scooped chicken tikka masala onto a mound of rice. "That's wonderful," Mrs. Richardson said. "The adoption agent says we're ideal candidates. She thinks they'll have a match for us within 6 months." Mrs. McCullough took a sip of water. "She says that coming from China, the odds of the baby's family trying to regain custody are almost nil." Mrs. Richardson leaned across the table to squeeze her old friend's hand. "That will be a very lucky baby," she said. This was what would haunt Mrs. McCullough most. that Mirabel hadn't cried out when Bibi had reached into the crib and lifted her up and taken her away. Despite everything, despite the homemade food and the toys and the late nights and the love, so much love, more love than Mrs. McCullough could have imagined possible. Despite it all, she still had felt Bibi's arms were a safe place, a place she belonged. This next baby, she told herself, coming from an orphanage, would never have known another mother. She would be theirs, without question. Already, Mrs. McCullough felt dizzy with love for this child she had yet to meet. She tried not to think about Mirabel, the daughter they'd lost, out there somewhere living some other foreign life. That final night, as they pulled away from the Richardson's house, Pearl had dropped the keys into the Richardson's mailbox with a clatter and climbed back into the car and finally voiced the question that had been clinging to the tip of her tongue. What if those are the pictures that were going to make you famous? They would not be. That would be the idea just beginning to sparkle in Mia's mind as she flicked on the headlights. A wisp of an idea, not yet coalesced into an image, let alone words. As it happened, the Richardsons would never sell those photos. They would keep them, and the photos would assume the status of uneasy family heirlooms, something later generations would wonder about when at last that dusty box in the attic was found and opened. Where those photographs had come from, who had made them, what they meant. For now, Mia eased the car into first gear. Then I'll owe them much, much more than the price of the photos. She guided the rabbit past the duck pond, across Van Aken and the rabbit tracks, toward Warrensville Road, which would take them to the highway out of Cleveland and onward. I wish I'd had a chance to say goodbye. Pearl thought about Moody, about Lexi and Tripp, the threads that still bound her to each of them in different ways. Over the years, over the course of her life, she would try repeatedly to untangle these threads and find each time that they were hopelessly intertwined. And Izzy. I wish I'd gotten to see her one last time. Mia was quiet, thinking of Izzy, too. Poor Izzy, she said at last. She wants to get out of there so badly. An idea began to form in Pearl's mind in wild, golden loops. We could go back and get her. I could climb up the back porch and knock on her window and... My darling, Mia said, Izzy is only 15. There are rules about that kind of thing. But as the car sped down Warrensville Road and toward I-480, Mia allowed herself a brief fantasy. They would be driving down a two-lane road, some back highway, the kind Mia favored, the kind that wove its way through small towns composed of a store and a cafe and a gas pump. Dust would billow in the air as they went by like golden clouds. They would come around a curve, and out of that golden mist, they would see a shadowy figure by the roadside, arm out, one thumb up. Mia would slow the car, and as the dust settled, they would see her hair first, a billow of gold on gold, recognizing that wild hair, that golden wildness, even before they saw her face, even before they could stop and fling the door wide and let her in. Saturday morning, as Mia and Pearl crossed into Iowa, Izzy, the smell of smoke still clinging faintly to her hair, climbed aboard a Greyhound bus headed for Pittsburgh. Across town, her family was just now gathering on the bank of the duck pond, watching the firefighters douse the Richardson house, flame by flame. She had, folded in her back pocket, an address she had found in her mother's files, which she had rifled through late the previous night after packing her bag. George and Regina Wright, Bethel Park, Pennsylvania. There had been a phone number, too, but Izzy knew a phone call would not give her the answers she needed. The file on her mother's desk, neatly labeled M.W. in her mother's careful writing, had been quite full, and she had read everything sitting in the lamplight in her mother's office chair while everyone slept quietly upstairs. Below the Wright's address, she copied another, Anita Rees, the Rees Gallery. It was somewhere in New York City. Mia, she knew, had started there when she was not much older than Izzy. She wondered what it would be like. Maybe one of these people would help her find Mia, wherever she might be headed.
Maybe they would send her back to her parents. And if they did, she would leave again. She would leave again and again until she was old enough that no one could send her back. She would keep searching until she found what she was looking for. Pittsburgh beckoned, and beyond it, New York. Mia's past, but her future. They would lead her to Mia somehow.
Now, settling into a seat and leaning her head against the window, she imagined how it would go. She would spot Mia from behind first,
but of course she would recognize her immediately. Izzy knew her outline like a shape she traced over and over until she knew it by heart. She would find Mia, and when Mia turned, she would open her arms. She would take Izzy in and take her with her, wherever she would go next.
That last night, as Mrs. Richardson settled down to sleep in the Winslow house for the first time, she began to think, as she would for a long time, of her youngest child. The noises of the house were foreign to her, the hum of the fridge, the faint rumble of the furnace downstairs, the squeak of a branch rubbing the slate roof overhead. And she rose and went outside and sat on the steps of the little duplex, her bathrobe wrapped tightly around her. Under her feet, the cement stoop was cool and slightly damp, as if a fog had just lifted. All day long she had been fuming at Izzy, both internally and aloud.
"Ungrateful child," she had said. "How could she do this? What she wasn't going to do when they found her? She would be grounded for life. She'd be sent to boarding school, military school, a convent. She had half a mind to let the police have her. Let her learn about consequences in jail."
Her husband and children, used to her flares of fury at Izzy, nodded quietly, let her rant. But this was different from other times. This time, Izzy had crossed every line. And now, each member of the family was slowly realizing she might never be back. The police were searching for Izzy, of course. They'd put out an alert for her as a runaway and a possibly endangered child. And in the days to come, Mrs. Richardson would give them photos for bulletins and posters, would track Izzy's friends and classmates one by one, searching for clues about where she might have gone. But the ones who might have known, she realized, had already gone. All up and down the street, the houses looked like any others. But inside them were people who might be happy, or taking refuge, or steeling themselves to go out into the world, searching for something better. So many lives she would never know about, unfolding behind those doors. It was nearly midnight, and a car drove down Winslow quickly, its high beams on, as if it had somewhere important to be, then disappeared into the darkness.
She probably looked crazy to the neighbors, she thought, sitting out there on the steps in the dark. But for once, she did not care.
The anger she had stoked all day had burned away, like the heat of the afternoon burning off as evening fell.